At that moment, the lights in the auditorium dimmed and the lights on stage came up, and Jerry O'Malley walked out in black tie with two other tuxedoed men. He bowed and sat down at the piano. After a moment, he nodded, and the trio started to play an old Lerner and Lane tune, "You're All the World to Me," and he sang it right to Dina. Among the thousands of things Dina did not know about Jerry O'Malley was that he had worked his way through college with his own jazz combo, playing every weekend at parties. Tonight, he had managed to get both of the other guys, one a doctor now and the other with his own venture capital business, to come into Manhattan for the evening to back him up. Dina sat as he continued to play every love song he knew and a few really funny ones with lyrics she suspected he had written. Jerry O'Malley was either off his rocker or else he thought she could get him on television. Whichever it was very embarrassing. But after a while, she began to relax and to really enjoy herself. When it was over, she stood and applauded. He came down to where she was sitting and said, "Well, well... Wow, you really can play." He introduced the other musicians to her, and she told them how much she had enjoyed the concert. Then Jerry took Dina to dinner at the Russian tea room next door. "Dina," he said, "I'm the last person in the world who wants to pressure you. All I want you to know is that I'm here, and I'm in love with you." "Are you serious?" "Absolutely," Jerry said. "I told you on the phone, or tried to." "Well, to tell you the truth, Jerry, I thought you were kidding. I mean, you're a psychiatrist. Aren't you supposed to know better or something?" Dina had been in 17 cities in 17 days on a 28-day promotion tour for the network. They decided that she was the perfect person to send across the country to their local affiliates because of her increasing popularity. They knew she would charm and interest everyone she met. Dina had been doing a terrific job charming everyone until Pittsburgh, when her stomach began to hurt again. She tried to drive herself through it by living on Maalox and Tums. Right after she finished speaking at a big benefit dinner in Houston, honoring the great heart surgeon, Dr. Michael E. DeBakey, she was leaving the hotel to catch a plane to Dallas when she passed out cold. When she came to, she and Johnny Hartman, her publicist, were in the back of a police car with the siren going all the way to the hospital, and before she knew it, she was in the emergency room with doctors examining her, talking about the possibility of emergency surgery. After a few minutes, like a parting of the waters, the doctors and nurses stepped aside as Dr. Michael DeBakey, still in his tux from the dinner, walked in and took over. He smiled and talked to Dina as he examined her. "So, how long have you had trouble with your stomach?" "Not long," Dina lied. He continued to check her out thoroughly, then said to his staff, "No need to prep." He took Dina's hand. "You're going to live. Now, what I'm going to do is give you a little something to help you with that pain. We're going to take a little blood, then we're going to take you upstairs and put you to bed so I can keep an eye on you. I'll stop in and see you in the morning." The next day, Dina was still asleep when Dr. DeBakey looked in. Johnny, tired and frazzled after a night in the waiting room, said, "Doctor, is she all right? It wasn't a heart attack, was it?" "No, Miss Hartman, her heart is fine. She had a severe attack of gastroenteritis, inflammation of the stomach lining, probably brought on by stress." "Thank God it happened here, Doctor. And I hate to bother you, but I need to know how long it will be before you think she might be back up on her feet." "I don't care, but the head of the network publicity has already called me a dozen times to see if I can give them an idea when she might be able to continue her tour. They need to know how many cities they have to cancel and how soon she'll be able to do at least some phone interviews. They're hoping she can pick up in Denver on Wednesday." Dr. DeBakey pointed to the paper Johnny was holding. "Is that her schedule?" "Yes." DeBakey put on his glasses and studied it. Then he called Johnny's boss, Andy Brill, in New York, and said, "Let me ask you a question, Mr. Brill."
"Yes?"
"Are you people trying to kill her? Miss Hartman showed me her schedule. How could you expect anyone to keep going at that pace?" I don't think you understand. This thing has been booked for over 6 months. We've got commitments here. Mr. Brill, I don't think you understand. This girl is suffering from extreme exhaustion and serious stomach distress brought on by exhaustion and stress. What are you saying? I'm saying that as long as she is my patient, she is not leaving this hospital for at least 2 weeks. You can expect her back at work in maybe a month. Would you like that in writing? And if she does go back any sooner, and if anything happens to her health as a result, I'm perfectly prepared to go on record that your network was forewarned. When Mackie and Norma Warren came in from church, their phone was ringing. Norma picked it up, her purse still hanging on her arm. Mrs. Mackie Warren? Yes? Mrs. Warren, my name is Johnny Hartman, and I work with Network News Public Relations, and I'm calling to let you know that your relative, Dina Nordstrom, is in the hospital here. Norma did not let her finish, put her hand over the receiver, and screamed at her husband. Mackie, I told you not to kill that cricket. Baby girl is in the hospital. She turned back to the phone. Oh, my God, what's the matter with her? Mrs. Warren, I don't want to alarm you, but don't tell me she's been in an accident. Don't tell me she's been hurt. I can't stand it. I'll just go to pieces. Here, you have to talk to my husband. She thrust the phone at Mackie as if it were on fire. Mackie took the phone while Norma wailed in the background. If she's dead, just don't tell me. I can't stand it. I knew something like this was going to happen. Norma, be quiet. Hello, this is her husband. What's going on? Mr. Warren, this is Johnny Hartman, and I don't want to alarm you. I just wanted to call and let you know that Dina is in the hospital, but okay, in case you might hear something on the news. I'm here with her at the Houston Medical Center, and Dr. DeBakey has just examined her and said she had a pretty severe attack of gastroenteritis. Mackie nodded. I see. Is this considered life-threatening? Norma wailed again. Oh, don't say she's dying. Oh, no, Mr. Warren. It's just a pretty severe stomach ache, as far as I can tell. The doctor says all she needs is a little rest, and I really don't want you and your wife to worry. She has one of the best doctors, Michael E. DeBakey. Mackie was impressed. The heart transplant doctor? He anticipated Norma's reaction and caught her just before she started to scream, heart transplant. No, Norma, it's not her heart. That's her doctor. Her doctor? Her doctor has had a heart transplant? Norma, he's fine. Norma stood up. Oh, I can't stand it, Mackie. You're not asking the right questions. Give me the phone. Miss Hartman, this is Norma again. Is this doctor good? Because we have a doctor right here in town that we can get, one that's in good health. Mackie shook his head in disbelief and said in a quiet, steely voice, Norma, give me the phone and go sit down. Reluctantly, she handed it back. Well, you have to ask about these things. Miss Hartman, we really appreciate your call, and I would also appreciate it if you could call us tomorrow and just let us know how she's doing. An hour later, Norma picked up the phone in the kitchen and dialed Aunt Eleanor while Mackie made himself a ham and cheese sandwich. Aunt Eleanor, were you taking a nap? It's Norma. Put on your hearing aid, honey. Well, now that we know it's not life-threatening, the tale can be told. Are you sitting down? Well, go sit down. I don't want you falling out with a stroke. Well, the whole thing started last night at about 10:30. We had been in bed for an hour when we heard a cricket in the living room, and Mackie got up without his glasses and stepped on it and killed it. Well, I know it's bad luck to kill a cricket, Aunt Eleanor. That's probably the reason baby girl wound up in the hospital in the first place. After Dina had been in the hospital for a few days, she began to feel better. When Dr. DeBakey came in today, she explained to him why he had to let her out to pick up the rest of the cities on the tour. He took her hand. Honey, I know you're disappointed that you can't go back to work. You feel a little better, so you think you're ready to get up and start running again. I've heard it from my patients more times than I can tell you. But this flare-up is a warning that your body just cannot go at this pace. And once you do permanent damage, you can't get your health back. You have to slow down now, before it's too late. I've called your family, Mr. and Mrs. Warren, and they've already made arrangements to come here on Saturday with a car and take you home and look after you for a while. Dina was alarmed. What? The dietitian gave instructions to Mrs. Warren as to what you can eat. Dr. DeBakey, wait a minute. You don't understand. I don't even know these people. I mean, well, not well. We're related, but I can't go home with them. Oh, I see. Well, do you have other family? No, but I can take care of myself. No, you can't. You're going to need someone to prepare all your meals, keep people away from you, and not let you use the phone. Now, you can stay in the hospital here with us, or you can let me arrange to hire a 24-hour-a-day nurse and put you in our aftercare clinic. That's up to you. But one way or the other, young lady, you have got to rest. Elmwood Springs, February the 13th, 1976. That first morning, Dina woke up in a strange room with a small, plump woman she had never seen before, sitting in a chair across the room, staring at her and fanning herself with a small brown paper bag. As Dina opened her eyes, the woman said, "Well, I know you were glad to get out of that old hospital, weren't you, honey?" Dina managed a weak, "Yes," wondering who in the world this old lady was. "Well, we sure are glad you're home where you belong," I kept saying to Norma. "When is baby girl getting out of that hospital and coming home? I don't envy anybody in the hospital." "No." "Did I ever tell you about the time Norma carried me up to the hospital for a checkup?" "No." Dina wondered if she had suddenly stepped into the twilight zone. "Oh, yeah. That bed they had me in was like sleeping on a bunch of cantaloupes. I will say this, though. That bed could do anything you wanted it to, go up and down, flat or tilted. It did everything but dance the polka with you and kiss you good night. When they had me up there, they looked at me up and down every which way but sideways from stem to stern. And after they finished, I said to that doctor, I said, 'You're just like that TV show, Star Trek.' 'How so?' he says. I said, 'Honey, you've been places where no man has ever dared to go.'" Norma came into the room with a tray. "Good morning. I was telling baby girl here about my hospital stay, how they checked me out, and how he said all my numbers looked good, whatever that meant. But it finally calmed Norma down, didn't it, Norma?" Norma said begrudgingly, "Yes, but everybody needs a checkup once in their life." The old lady winked at Dina. "She's a scared I'm going to die on her." Norma placed Dina's tray in front of her. "Here, honey, I want you to try and eat this." Dina sat up and looked at a bowl of milk with a piece of toast floating in it. After Norma left the room, Aunt Eleanor said, "That girl worries herself into a frazzle over everything. If I don't call her by 7 a.m., she has me dead and buried." I said to her, I says, "Norma, when I finally do go, it's going to be anticlimactic. You won't even be surprised. You've been practicing for so many years." Aunt Eleanor pointed to the twirling trophies on the shelf that belonged to Norma's daughter, Linda. "You know poor old Dixica Hill died last year." Dina had no idea who Dixica Hill was. "No, I didn't." "Well, she did. Of course, she was well up into her 80s, but still teaching when she went. They buried her in tap shoes and with her batons." Norma came back as Aunt Eleanor went on. "Baby girl, since you were last here, Hatcher's mortuary moved outside of town, and now they've got a new drive-through funeral home." "I'm sorry?" asked Dina, who was trying in self-defense to eat. "They have a drive-by window to view the remains." Norma added, "Oh, it's just some lame-brained idea James Hatcher came up with." Aunt Eleanor said, "Well, instead of ordering a burger and fries, you drive through and look at a dead relative." "No, I believe I'm going to get myself cremated, thank you. I don't want anybody looking at me without me knowing it. What if Darlene did my hair funny? You know how horrified we were when she decided to give old Miss Alexander bangs. Everybody forgot about her being dead and just looked at her bangs. Come on, Aunt Eleanor, Norma said. Let's let her get some rest now.
Oh, all right.
Well, bye, honey. I can bring my cat Sonny up tomorrow if you'd like.
Aunt Eleanor, you are not bringing that cat over here and getting fleas all over my house. Dina smiled wanly.
Well, bye. Thanks for coming.
When they closed the door, Dina thought, I have to get out of here. The second morning, Dina had another visitor. At 8 o'clock, Dr. Jerry O'Malley arrived at the front door, dressed as a 15th century troubadour, complete with pink tights and a plumed hat, and carrying a dozen red roses and a mandolin. He told Mackie he had a Valentine's surprise for Dina. Dina came downstairs and went to the door. She did not see anybody at first, but she looked down and saw roses spread out in a big heart-shaped design with a card in the middle. As soon as she walked out on the porch, she heard music. She looked down and saw Jerry O'Malley standing in the yard, dressed in some idiotic costume, playing a mandolin and singing something about love. She could not believe her eyes. As she stood there in her robe, shivering in the cold, the neighbors started peering out of their windows one by one. Dina could hardly believe what she was seeing or hearing. After his song, he took off his hat and bowed and drove off, leaving her standing still in a sleepy daze, trying to figure out what Jerry O'Malley was doing in Elmwood Springs, Missouri at 8 o'clock in the morning. Or was she having some sort of hallucination? She reached down and picked up the card and read it. No pressure, just know I adore you. Happy Valentine's Day. Love, Jerry. She picked up the roses and went back inside. Norma poked her head around the kitchen corner.
Would your little friend like to come in? He's perfectly welcome.
No, that's okay. He's gone. Here's some flowers, if you want them.
Oh, aren't they beautiful? Well, I'll put them in a vase, and then you can have them in your room. Well, wasn't he nice to bring you these?
He certainly seemed like a very nice person, said Norma, just dying to know who he was, but not asking. Dina started back upstairs. He's nice, but I'm beginning to think he's a little crazy or something. A few days later, Dina went downtown, supposedly to visit Mackie's hardware store, but her real reason was to get to a phone. As soon as she turned the corner, she went into the Rexall drugstore and called New York.
Mr. Cooper, you have a collect call from Dina Nordstrom. Will you accept?
Yes, put her on. Well, hello. How are you feeling? Are you getting some rest down there?
Sandy, I want you to get me out of here as soon as possible.
When she hung up and came out of the booth, several people were waiting to say hello to her and to tell her how glad they were to see her home. After a moment, she walked by a place that seemed vaguely familiar. At least it smelled familiar. It was the bakery they said her grandparents used to own. It was still called Nordstrom's Swedish Bakery, even though there were new owners. She cupped her hands around her eyes and peered inside, but nothing looked familiar. It was odd to walk down the street. People kept coming out of the stores and greeting her as if they were old friends, people she had never seen before in her life. Everybody knew who she was, but when they spoke to her, the older ones referred to her as Jean's daughter, and the younger ones as Norma's cousin or Aunt Eleanor's niece. It was the first time in her life she had ever been referred to as anything but Dina Nordstrom. People kept stopping her and telling her about how they had grown up with her father, or that he had once been their paper boy and what a fine fellow he was. It seemed that everybody had a tale about her father or her grandparents they wanted her to hear. Finally, what seemed like hours later, she reached the hardware store. Soon Mackie had shown her all his fishing flies and explained each one by name and what fish it was used to catch. She said, Mackie, did you know my father? He nodded, very well, and your grandparents. Today she had been pleasantly surprised. Elmwood Springs was really a nice little town, and all the people who had come up to her had seemed very nice. She suddenly began to wonder what it was that had caused her mother to move away. What had happened? The next morning at breakfast, Dina said, "Norma, what did you know about my mother?" Norma was caught off guard for a moment.
Well, baby girl, not much. What is it you'd like to know?"
"Oh, what she was like when she was here and things like that." Norma put a plate in the dishwasher and closed it and sat down across from Dina.
"Well, I can only tell you what I know. I was in high school, I guess, or maybe I had graduated by then. But, you know, she wasn't here all that long, and she stayed mostly to herself. Oh, I do remember we would go up to your grandmother's house, that was my Aunt Gerda, to see you, and she was always so proud of you, bought you all kinds of toys. You know, Aunt Eleanor could probably tell you more than I could. We could talk to her if you'd like."
"Yes, I think I would." That afternoon, they were on Aunt Eleanor's porch.
"Aunt Eleanor, I wonder if you remember anything about my mother?"
Norma said, "I've told baby girl everything I remember."
"Well, honey, let me sit here and tax my memory. Lord, that was a piece ago, wasn't it? But of course I do. I remember that first day she came here. You were just a little tiny baby, and we went down to the train station to meet Jean's wife. He'd written of how pretty she was, but we had no idea she was going to be that pretty. We were all standing there, and here this glamorous creature steps down from the train, and we almost couldn't believe our eyes. She looked like she had just stepped right out of a magazine. She had on this aqua wool dress, and her hair was swept way up on her head, and she had this little smart pancake of a hat tilted over one eye. Oh, I tell you, she was a fashion plate if I ever saw one. Well, let's put it this way. We had never seen anything like her in Elmwood Springs. Beautiful red hair and that creamy white skin and those green eyes. You got Jean's eyes, but you got your mother's figure. Well, we were all anxious to get a look at you. You were Jean's baby, and you just sort of broke the ice. And when we saw you, oh, we were all just tickled to death. You couldn't miss you were Jean's baby, all right, with that towhead of white hair and those big blue eyes. She had you all dressed up in the cutest baby outfit, a little pink dress with lace, and she had a big pink bow tie tied across your head."
Dina said, "How did she seem?"
"If anything, she was shy. She wouldn't let anybody take her picture. And I said, 'Oh, as pretty as you are, you need to have your picture made.' But she wouldn't."
"Did she seem unfriendly?"
"Oh, no, no. She was a very sweet and soft-spoken person, but sort of reserved. Wouldn't you say, Norma?"
"Yes, I guess you could say that. Not that she wasn't perfectly friendly, mind you."
Aunt Eleanor agreed.
"No, she was perfectly friendly and pleasant. But you could tell right away that she was not one of those flighty young girls that some of the boys brought home. Not only was your mother pretty, she was refined and well-spoken. And she wrote with a beautiful hand, well-educated and from a good family. But, you know, she never talked about them and were never asked. We didn't want to open a sore spot. We thought if she wanted to talk about them that she would. She lost her entire family in the fire. Oh, and then to lose Jean. I just don't know how she stood it. But you could tell it had affected her. She always seemed a little sad or something. Even though she never talked about it, you could tell she never got over it. She never showed her emotions much. She didn't cry, or at least none of us ever saw her. She just got a job, went to work every day, and came home and played with you at night. Otherwise, she just never went out, never saw anybody. And then one day, I guess you were about 4, she just upped and left. Packed your things, took you out of nursery school, and left. She said she wanted to get a better job, and she couldn't get one in Elmwood Springs, so she just took off, and she never came back. You just broke your poor grandparents' heart."
"Did you ever meet anybody she knew?" Dina asked. "Did anybody at all ever come to see her?"
Aunt Eleanor thought, "No, no, nobody ever did. She never had anybody come and see her. Nobody except that Italian man that time."
Norma looked at Aunt Eleanor. "Italian?"
You never told me about any Italian man.
Well, I forgot. I think he was an Italian or a Greek or something, some kind of foreigner. I only saw him through a screen door, but he had kind of a slicky hair. He walked up on the porch and knocked on the door and asked if your mother lived there, and Gerda went to get her. But I can tell you, whoever he was, she didn't like him very much. Your mother didn't even invite him in. She had impeccable manners, but the minute she saw him, she took him way out on the sidewalk and way away from the house. I was just sitting there in the living room, and I couldn't help but look. I could see right out the screen door. Whoever he was, your mother was not happy at all he showed up. I can tell you that. And whatever she said must have run him off, because after about 10 minutes, he was gone. When she came back in the house, you could tell that she is still upset. Her little face was all flushed. Norma was amazed. And she never said who he was?
Nope.
And you didn't ask? No, Norma, I don't poke in other people's affairs. Just pass and repass, I always say. She didn't volunteer, and we didn't ask. I think he may have been some old boyfriend who found out that her husband had been killed and showed up trying to get her to go out with him.
Did he ever come back? Dina asked.
No, not to my knowledge. But now your mother left town shortly after that, so I haven't any idea if he ever bothered her again or not.
Norma said, "Did you hear what they were arguing about?"
Oh, I could hear them, but I couldn't understand what it was they were saying. They were talking in a foreign language.
Both of them?
Well, sure, honey. You can't have one person talking one language and the other one talking something else.
Well, what language were they speaking?
Aunt Eleanor said, "Well, now that was the funny thing. Like I said, he looked Italian, but they were talking in German."
Norma was not convinced. Oh, Aunt Eleanor, now think back. Are you sure it was German? Don't you think it might have been Italian or maybe Spanish even?
Aunt Eleanor said, "No. Don't forget your Uncle Will's father was a Schemfissel. All he spoke was German, so I know German when I hear it. It was German, all right. That much I'm sure of."
Dina had no idea that her mother had spoken German and was thrilled the next morning when a telegram arrived. "I'm sorry to inform you that your beloved agent and show business icon, Sandy Cooper, passed away suddenly last evening. Please return to New York at once. Julian Amesley, Network President." Later that night, when she got off the plane in New York, Sandy said, "Well, how do I look for a dead man?" "Beautiful," Dina said, and was happy to be back. One of the first things she did when she got to her apartment was to sit down and type a letter. "Dear Jerry, thank you so much for your flowers. I know you went to a lot of trouble to bring them to me, and I really do appreciate it. However, I think it would be unfair of me to keep you from pursuing a relationship with the kind of woman that you deserve to be with. You are too nice of a guy to lead on. I hope we can be friends in the future, and I wish you all the best in everything you do. Sincerely, Dina Nordstrom." As the months went by, Dina was getting better and better interviews. Sandy even heard serious rumblings that they were considering moving her to a co-anchor spot on the 6 o'clock news. But in the meantime, Ira Wallace was very happy with her work. The ratings were still climbing, and Upstairs was pleased, too. Competition was heating up, too, and Dina's interviews were getting rougher and rougher. It made her uneasy, particularly when she remembered that Howard Kingsley might be watching her. Pete Kosky had been elected to the governor of his state mostly because he had been a championship football star. But after 12 years in politics, he had turned out to be a respected member of his party, and now there was a lot of talk about him being asked to run for president in the upcoming campaign. Ira briefed Dina for her interview. As soon as she sat down and saw that look on his face, she prepared herself for the worst. "Your Mr. Macho Hall of Famer has a son that's as queer as a $3 bill. Got his little fairy butt kicked out of the army for playing house with some other fairy. But Kosky had it fixed so it wouldn't show up on his record.
How's that for a nice little cherry bomb to throw in? Oh, God, Ira, why won't you let me just have one interview without trying to turn it into some ambush? It's the truth, Wallace yelled defensively. Capello's got the goddamn record out of the goddamn military files, and he's got a statement from one of his boyfriends. Dina stared at him. Ira, I told you before that I wouldn't work with Capello. You lied. You didn't fire him, did you? You think I would quit working with the best son of a bitch in the business just because you don't like him? I got him out of your face, didn't I? What else do you want from me? Now, I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. You work for me, not Howard Kingsley. Me. You ask the questions that I tell you to. What does Howard Kingsley have to do with this? Don't play innocent with me. Everybody knows what's been going on with you two. Who do you think you're kidding? Ira, I hope you're not serious. You know that's not true. Hey, what you do is your own business. Don't try and con me, that's all. Read this. He pushed a copy of a medical discharge toward her and an army psychiatrist's private notes. See? He admits it. What more do you want? Dina looked at him in disbelief. We can't use this, Ira. This is illegal. Capello should be in jail, and that's where you're going to wind up if you're not careful, and I'd be going with you, and I'm not doing it. Dina meant it. She had already ruined one man's political life. She wasn't going to do it again. Dina had just walked into her office one morning when her secretary handed her a news report that had just come in over the wire. Sag Harbor, New York. Howard Kingsley, the conscience of broadcasting, has died at his home of heart failure. He was 68 years of age. Howard had retired only a few months earlier. Dina had spent Thanksgiving with him and his family at the Kingsleys' country home in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. She couldn't believe he was gone. Lee Kingsley called Dina and told her they were going to scatter Howard's ashes in a quiet ceremony from his boat, the Lee Ann. We want you to be there, Dina. I know that Howard would have liked that. He thought so much of you. So please come. Dina said that she would. They rowed out, and the water was calm and quiet, except for the seagulls following the boat. When they dropped anchor, Lee served champagne. And a little later, as the sun was beginning to set, Lee stood up. As you all know, Howard loved this place from the day we came here 37 years ago. He fell in love with the town and the people, and this boat was where he spent some of his happiest hours. One by one, those present said a few things about Howard. Dina was too moved to say anything. A friend, John, spoke last. I thought of hundreds of things that I could say, things I'd like to say about Howard, about the kind of man he was, the kind of friend. But, you know, even now, I can hear that old bastard saying, get on with it, John. We don't want any of your overblown sentimental prose, so I'll just say goodbye and safe harbor, old friend. The sun was beginning to fade as they watched the mild wind that had come up blow Howard's ashes across the water. Everyone held up their glasses to toast Howard, except Dina, who totally and unexpectedly lost complete control. She burst into tears and began to sob. She tried to stop, but she couldn't. Watching those ashes disappear had triggered something inside her. It was so final. If anyone was surprised by her sudden burst of emotion, they could not have been more surprised than Dina, who prided herself on control at all costs. She was horrified. They were all going to think that she had had an affair with him the way she was carrying on. As they turned and headed home, they saw boats of many shapes and sizes had lined up behind them. The boats sat motionless in the water, their owners flying their flags at half-mast as a tribute to their neighbor. The boats remained still until after the Lee Ann had passed. Then they all rowed out in single file and made a slow circle around the area where Howard's ashes had been scattered and headed back to harbor. When Dina saw that, she sobbed even more. By the time they got to the house, she had to be put on a bed in a room off the living room.
Lee brought her a cold, wet washcloth and put it across Dina's eyes, now red and swollen. After Lee left, Dina tried to think, what in the world was she crying about? Was it something about saying goodbye? Was it about her own father? She didn't think so. She had not even known him. What was wrong? Maybe she was just weeping about living in a world without Howard. Atlanta, Georgia, 1978. 6 months after Howard's death, Dina spoke at the Mississippi College for Women, and Suki had driven her back to Atlanta. They were driving around and looking at houses, killing time before Dina had to get back on the plane to New York.
"Oh, I wish I had paid more attention to current events when I was in school," Suki said. "Then maybe I wouldn't be surprised at what's happening now in the world. I was so busy trying to be liked."
"You were liked."
"Yes, but I had to work at it. You didn't have to. People just liked you automatically. I had to run around like a chicken, smiling, joining this and joining that. I never got a good rest until after I was married."
"Suki, have you ever spent any time alone? I mean, really alone?" Suki thought about it.
"Well, why would I want to?"
"Don't people ever get on your nerves?"
"No."
Suki suddenly spotted something.
"Look at that. Now, why in the world would anybody paint their house that color? Will you tell me?"
Dina looked at the lavender house with the dark purple shutters. "God only knows. But seriously, Suki, I'm really interested in knowing why you like people."
"Well, what a silly thing to ask. Because, why shouldn't I like people? You're supposed to like other people. Well, everybody likes other people, don't they?"
"Well, I don't know if I do or I don't. I wouldn't mind living in a house in the woods all alone."
"Well, if you ask me, you're alone too much as it is. You need to have somebody to talk to share your innermost thoughts with."
"Don't worry. I have a psychiatrist. I pay a lot of money to share my innermost thoughts." Suki was alarmed and almost ran the car off the road.
"A psychiatrist? Oh, you don't need to go to some psychiatrist, Dina Nordstrom. I can tell you what's wrong with you, absolutely free. You think you don't like people, but you do. You're just scared of them, so you stay alone."
Dina sighed. "Suki, I have so many people around me all day. Believe me, I am not alone."
"No, I mean when you go home at night and on holidays, for instance. Now, who are you with on Christmas?"
"God, not this again. There are plenty of places I can go. Suki, why can't we just have a nice visit without you constantly badgering me?" Suki kept driving. For a long time, she did not answer.
"Dina, I have something I have to tell you."
She pulled over to the curb and turned off the engine. She looked straight ahead, took a deep breath. Her eyes were closed.
"Dina, I know about your mother."
Dina, startled, said, "What?"
"There, I've said it, and I'm glad. I know I'm taking a chance of losing you as a friend, but before you get furious at me, I didn't mean to find out. It was an accident."
"What are you talking about?"
"Oh, it was a stupid thing to do, I know, but we were, well, all of us girls in the house used to think you had a secret boyfriend, and, well, they put me up to looking to see if you had any love letters stashed away, and, well, I accidentally read the letter from your grandfather by mistake."
Dina felt her face getting hot and flushed, and her heart was racing.
"I know I shouldn't have done it. I know it and know it, and I am so sorry."
Dina did not say a word. Suki was miserable.
"Dina, if you don't say something, I'm going to have a heart attack."
Dina spoke. "Who else did you tell?"
"Nobody."
Suki was emphatic.
"Do you think that I would tell anybody else? I didn't even tell you until now. I wanted to, but I was a coward. I wanted you to like me, and you kept telling me you were spending all your holidays with your mother and what a wonderful time you'd had. I just couldn't very well come out and say I knew you were lying, could I?"
Dina took a drag of her cigarette. "Have you told Earl?" Suki reacted in horror.
"Earl? Well, why in the world would I tell Earl? No, I haven't told anybody.
Her chin began to quiver, and she was on the verge of tears. I'm sorry that I read that letter, but I would never betray you, and it just hurts my feelings to think that you would think that I would.
Dina put her cigarette out in the ashtray.
You were spying on me. What do you call that?
That wasn't spying. I thought it was just boyfriend stuff. That does not count for serious spying, and you know it.
Sookie saw the Varsity Drive-In sign. Can we pull in here a minute? I'm just a nervous wreck. She parked and turned her engine off. A girl came up, and Sookie ordered a large Coke. Dina ordered nothing. Sookie said, Listen, Dina, now I know you're mad at me, but you wanted to know why I worry about you and badger you, and that's why.
I think you still lie to me about where you go and what you do on holidays. You spend too much time alone, and that's not good for a person, and I just don't care what you say.
Sookie, if you knew about my mother, then why did you insist on babbling on and on about how happy and how great everything was back then when you knew better?
Sookie threw her hands up in the air. Oh, I know, I know. Don't ask me why. Oh, I just always felt so guilty about it. I guess I just couldn't face the fact that I knew that I let you down because I couldn't deal with it myself.
She turned to Dina.
Why did you lie to me? I was your best friend.
Dina reached for Sookie's glass. Give me a sip of that. After she drank, she said, Because I was embarrassed.
Embarrassed? But why? It wasn't your fault. Besides, Dina, it's nothing to be ashamed of.
I'm not ashamed.
Sookie took her hand. Don't you think we should talk about it? It must have just been terrible for you.
Well, there's nothing to talk about. Look, I don't even think about it anymore. That was a long time ago. Listen, Sookie, there are only a few people who know anything about it, and I'd like to keep it that way. Can you understand that?
Of course, Sookie said. First of all, it's nobody's business. And second of all, you don't want people to feel sorry for you or pity you. I understand perfectly. And as far as I'm concerned, it's forgotten. And you know that you can trust me with your life.
An hour later, when they arrived at the airport, Sookie hugged her goodbye. Dina paused a moment before she left, and even though it was hard for her to express her feelings, she said, Sookie, you really are a good friend.
That's what I've been telling you for years, Goofy.
Sookie had hated spying, but she was dying to find out what Dina's secret was. While two of her sorority sisters stood guard in the hall, she went over and quietly opened Dina's top drawer. She felt around for paper. Nothing. She went through all five drawers and came up empty-handed. She looked under the bed, under the pillows. Nothing. Then she remembered. Dina kept some papers in a box on the top shelf of her closet. She pulled a desk chair over, got the box down, and started shuffling through the papers. No letters, just grade transcripts, a couple of playbills, classroom notes, a newspaper article on Tennessee Williams, a typed letter from the scholarship board. Then down at the bottom, at last, she found a personal letter, and her heart started to pound. She opened it carefully, excited and full of guilt, and was riveted by what she read.
Dear Dina, I hope this letter finds you well. They have got me here at the VA hospital for some therapy. I know this has been a bad year for both of us. Baby girl, I wrote to tell you that I do not have good news about your mother, but it is not terrible news either. I have just received the final report from the Pinkerton fellow, and he informs me that after 2 years he can go no further in his investigation, but can say with some certainty that your mother is alive and is still in this country. And as long as she remains listed with the Bureau of Missing Persons, there is always a chance she will be found. Baby girl, don't ever let yourself get old. Mrs. Watson is a good nurse and puts me on a leash and walks me, so it's me and all the other old dogs that go round and round the block every afternoon. I miss home, but Aunt Eleanor keeps me well supplied with news and fig preserves. Do well in your studies. I have enclosed a check for a little dough I have managed to squirrel away. I remain your loving grandpa, Lorder Nordstrom, Sr. Sookie carefully folded the letter and put it in the box. She felt like a traitor for having read it. She waited a moment and then went to the door to the waiting girls and reported that she could not find a thing. After Christmas, when Dina came back from the holiday break and told her all about the wonderful time she had spent with her mother, Sookie said nothing. After Dina's grandfather died in 1963, Mackie went through his papers looking for a burial policy and anything else as executor he needed to know about. He had to pry open a little tin box. In it was a letter from a Chicago firm called Dunbar & Stratton, Resource Tracing Incorporated. It read, "Dear Mr. Nordstrom, using all the information at hand from your daughter-in-law's marriage certificate, her Social Security number, and the birth date and place given, we have not found a Marion Chapman born on that date in Washington, D.C., listed in any official records. We have repeatedly checked and rechecked all of our national research sources and have found only 11 Marion Chapmans born on or around that date, all of whom have been located and accounted for. According to our files and the census taken, no such person exists." Maggie talked it over with Norma, and they both decided not to tell Dina. As Norma said, what good would it do for her to know the person she thought was her mother didn't exist? Dina Nordstrom had ruined Sidney Capello's one chance to be a big producer in network television, but like a rat in a maze, he had quickly scurried in another direction. In the tabloid business, where speed does count, Capello had shot to the top like a silver bullet. For a while, he had continued to work with Ira Wallace, even though Dina knew nothing about it, but he had tired of being a freelance. So he started his own paper. Stripped of the dead weight of ethics, a conscience, or fear of the law, combined with his willingness to do anything to get a story, Capello and his paper were soon way ahead of the pack. He had no qualms about stealing mail, tapping phones, and bribing or even placing maids, gardeners, or chauffeurs in the homes of the well-known. His appetite for access to private information was boundless. He knew who was sleeping with whom, when, where, and how they did it, and could come up with at least one or two witnesses, and if necessary, and for enough money, he could provide the other person involved, whether that person had been there or not. He knew how almost any half-fact could be blown up into a scandal at a moment's notice. But the main reason for Sidney's success was his ability to look to the future, to put away something for a rainy day. He had this insurance file of his, chock full of tidbits, photos, documents that he could use when that rainy day came. If it had been a slow news week, he simply pulled something out that had been on hold, added a few factoids, and ran it. One aging movie star lost a lead in a movie when her before and after plastic surgery photo showed up in color on the cover of Capello's sheet for no reason other than it had been a slow week. He liked being on top, and he also had what he called a hot file, ready to go. His Get Them Before They're Famous time bombs. This is how the Dina Nordstrom file had come into being and now sat, ticking away, waiting for just the right moment. Capello was usually strictly business, but he took a personal interest in her story. If it had not been for Nordstrom, he might be producing television today. He had put his most expensive, tough-digging researcher, Barbara Zofko, to work on this one. What she had dug up exceeded even his wildest dreams. If Sidney Capello was the queen bee, Barbara Zofko was the perfect drone. She served him well. A lumpy, misshapen sort of a woman, with thick, slightly pockmarked, shiny white skin. Not ugly and not pretty. She had the kind of face that could walk past 1,000 people a day and not one would remember her. This characteristic worked in her favor. In fact, she was perfect for her job. She had no human relations to interfere with her work. Barbara Zofko did not mind eating alone. She preferred it. She was totally focused on her work and the next meal. She could eat a bag of cookies, an entire cake, a dozen donuts at one sitting. Barbara had never had enough of anything, love, money, or food, and no matter how much she ate, she never felt quite full. She was always left feeling just a little bit hungry, and that's why she was Capello's top bird dog. She had been on this case for several weeks now, and so far all she had been able to turn up on Dina Nordstrom was that she had attended schools all over the country, and that everyone remembered her, but few people remembered much about her. It was turning out to be difficult. Time to start on the immediate family. In Elmwood Springs, Missouri, she knocked on Norma Warren's front door. "Mrs. Warren?"
"Yes?"
"You don't know me, but I'm here from the governor's office in Jefferson City, and I wondered if I might talk to you about something concerning your cousin, Dina Nordstrom." Norma was surprised and caught off guard, as Zofko knew she would be. "It's a confidential matter."
Oh, well, of course. Oh, come in."
They went into the living room. "Mrs. Warren, this year the state of Missouri is setting up a Missouri Hall of Fame, and your cousin has been picked to receive the first Missouri Woman of the Year award." Norma drew in her breath.
"Really? Oh, you don't mean it."
"Yes, but we aren't announcing it to the press until next month, so I have to ask you to keep it under your hat."
"Oh, yes, of course. I understand. What an honor."
"We want it to be a surprise," Norma whispered.
"Even from Dina?"
"Yes, especially her."
"Oh, I understand. Mum's the word. Will there be a dinner or anything?"
Zofko was getting her tape recorder and notebook out of her satchel.
"Excuse me? Will there be a dinner or some sort of awards banquet?"
"Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Now, what we need from you, Mrs. Warren, is a little background information for the official bio."
Will it be formal, do you think?"
"Yes, I believe it will be. And if you have any photographs we could use, school pictures or..."
"Oh, I am so excited, I am about to faint.
Do you think that we could get an extra ticket for Aunt Elner? We'd just be happy to pay for the ticket. She's her great aunt, actually, and I know she would just be thrilled to pieces."
"Do you think the governor will be there?"
"Now, as I understand it, her father was born in Elmwood Springs." Norma stood up. "I am so excited. I haven't even offered you a thing. Would you like some coffee or anything?"
"No, I'm fine. Thank you. Well, I will take a Coke if you have it."
2 hours later, Norma was still talking about what a darling little girl Dina had been. "Her mother was working, so I took baby girl up to nursery school at neighbor Dorothy's house and picked her up every day. Oh, and she was the sweetest little thing. I remember her fourth birthday party. We had a big birthday cake for her. Her mother had her dressed up just like a little doll." "Mrs. Warren, when did Dina's mother pass away?"
"Oh, well, you know, it's been so long, I really couldn't say for sure."
"And when did she leave Elmwood Springs?"
She was about 4 and a half, I think."
Zofko decided to drop it for the moment. She could check that out later. "Mrs. Warren, I think that's enough. We'll get the pictures back to you as soon as we make copies. You've been very helpful."
"Oh, I hope so. You know what? I am so sorry, but I never got your name."
"Barbara." She stood up and shook hands with Norma and said, "Congratulations." After talking in circles with Dina's great aunt, a Mrs. Eleanor Shimfissel, Barbara Zofko left Elmwood Springs. The only item where there might have been something was the mother. She had noticed that both Mrs. Warren and Mrs. Shimfissel had been extremely sketchy and had seemed reluctant to talk much about her. But Zofko had her resources. She got the mother's Social Security number and began tracking her from the first job that she had ever had down to the last. Marion Chapman's record of employment was odd. She had first applied for a Social Security number in 1942 and had gone to work in a dress shop in New York City and had remained at that job until 1943 when she went to Gump's in San Francisco. From then on, she seemed to go from one job to the next, from one town to another. Zofko read and reread the copies of all the employee records and job applications she had managed to get a hold of. and this time noticed something that she had not caught before. A Lily's dress shop had been listed in all of Marion Chapman's references, then suddenly, after 1946, did not appear on any more applications. Why had she left that job out? Could something have happened there that might be the reason she was running? Zofko went to the New York City Library newspaper reference room, searching through 1937 and the 1938 advertisements in the New York area, and she found it. Lily's Exclusive Dress Shop. Clothes for the Discriminating Woman, 116 Park Avenue. She immediately went to the city records and looked up the address and the list of owners. It showed that the building at 116 Park had been sold to a Steiner, Lily Carlotta, in 1935 and sold back again in 1944 to Richter William J., the original owner. From there, it was easy. She called a woman who had worked for the New York Census Department and was on Sydney's payroll as well and told her to send everything she had on Lily Carlotta Steiner. Then she went back to her office and waited. The information came by messenger. Zofko ripped open the envelope as if it were a bag of M&Ms and devoured the contents with about as much relish. Steiner, Lily Carlotta, born Vienna, Austria, 1893, moved to New York, resided in Yorkville section at 463 East 85th Street, owned and operated fashionable dress shop until the time of her arrest. Closely associated with American Nazi Party members and accused of spying, and on December 13, 1946, was convicted and served 10 years in prison. Died in 1962 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. When Sidney Capello read the information she handed him, he looked at her. It doesn't get better than this. Write it. Hitler, Holocaust, death camps, the whole deal. Zofko went back to her office, sat down, and knocked out a few sample headlines and phrases. Dina Nordstrom's shameful Nazi past. Mother, war criminal. Leader of American Nazi Bund. Daughter of Nazi spy, now in American broadcasting. When she finished, she put it in the file with the rest. This little hand grenade would wait for a time when Sidney Capello decided to pull the pin and throw it at Nordstrom, the all-American girl. Every day, Norma scoured the papers looking for the announcement that Dina had been named Missouri Woman of the Year, and every morning she grabbed the mail hoping the banquet invitation would be there. After several months, she began to wonder if maybe they had made the announcement and somehow it had not made the Elmwood Springs paper, so she decided to check. She called the governor's office in Jefferson City and asked to speak to Barbara. The voice on the other end said, "Do you have a last name?" "No, but she works for the governor." "In what capacity?" "Careful not to give anything away," Norma answered. "She's in charge of awards." "I don't know who that would be, ma'am." "She didn't tell me her last name. Who's in charge of banquets?"
"Catering?"
"No, of writing up the programs."
"I don't know who that would be, ma'am."
"Oh, well, do you have anybody named Barbara working there?"
A pause. "Ma'am, I'm going to connect you with public relations. I have a Barbara Thomas listed."
"Is she a heavyset girl?"
"I don't know, ma'am. I'm just the switchboard operator." A woman picked up. "Hello, this is Barbara."
Norma whispered, "Barbara, is that you?"
"Yes, it is. Who's this?"
"It's me. The lady in Elmwood Springs. You know, the relative of you know who."
"I'm sorry? Who is this?"
"Is there anybody else on the line? Can I speak freely?"
"Yes."
"It's Norma, Norma Warren, the cousin of you-know-who in Elmwood Springs."
"Where?"
"Elmwood Springs. You paid me a little visit about 6 months ago."
"I don't think so. I've never..."
"Yes. Don't you remember about the AWARD?
"What award?"
"Don't you remember coming about the bio?"
"I'm afraid you must have the wrong person."
"Are you a heavyset girl with black hair?"
"No."
Oh, well, do you know a heavyset girl with black hair named Barbara?
No.
She works there. She's in charge of the big banquet.
What big banquet?
Well, if you don't know, I can't say. Would you put me back to the operator? I just seem to have the wrong Barbara. Sorry. And please, don't mention that I called.
Norma spoke to the only other Barbara who worked in the governor's office, but she was not the right one either. Norma was completely confused. She called Aunt Eleanor and asked if a woman named Barbara had ever come to her house. Aunt Eleanor, also sworn to secrecy, answered cautiously, "Who wants to know?"
"I do." "Well, I can't tell you. All I can tell you is that don't be surprised if you get an invitation in the mail any day now. And that's all I can say on the subject."
Aunt Eleanor and Norma both waited and waited, but nothing ever came. Dina went with Julian Amesley to see the musical Mame, a benefit performance for the Actors Fund, and it seemed as if all of New York was there. It was a glittering evening, and she admitted to herself that she enjoyed people whispering as she walked down the aisle,
"There's Dina Nordstrom."
Dina was thoroughly enjoying the show when halfway through the first act, she started to break out in a cold sweat and felt as if she could not breathe. Her heart began to pound and she heard a ringing in her ears. Everything suddenly became distorted and began to look unreal. The entire audience seemed to be moving in on her, and she was gasping for breath. She felt as if she was either going to die or to pass out. She stood up and was stepping over people, trying to get to the aisle. Julian turned around and half rose, but she was gone before he had a chance to ask her what was wrong. Dina made it to the ladies' room, ran to the sink, and held on, but her head was still spinning. The attendant was concerned when she saw her face, as white as her dress. "Are you all right, miss?" Dina was still fighting for breath and turned on the cold water and splashed herself in the face. The woman sat her down and said, "Just sit here and breathe as deeply as you can." Dina was still shaky but began to feel slightly better as the attendant kept talking to her and applied cold compresses to her wrists. "You probably just got too hot in there. Just try and relax. You'll be all right. When's your baby due?" The sudden thought that she might be pregnant snapped Dina back from wherever it was and into reality. Julian had been pursuing her relentlessly, and last month she had gotten pie-eyed at a party at his place and thought she might finally have gone to bed with him, but she couldn't be sure of the details, and the next morning she hadn't asked. She didn't want to know. The morning after her attack in the theater, Dina woke up scared to death and for the first time was actually glad she had an appointment with Dr. Diggers. She really needed to talk to someone. She told Dr. Diggers exactly what had happened the night before, including the thought that she might be pregnant. Dr. Diggers listened and jotted notes. Dina was irritated that she seemed so calm, so unconcerned. "Well, I'm glad you can sit there doodling or whatever it is you do while my whole life may be over. I may be carrying some Greek child that I don't even know." Elizabeth Diggers said, "You're not pregnant. You had an anxiety attack." "Oh, thank God." Dina breathed a sigh of relief. "Wait a minute. Why would I have an anxiety attack? Let's talk a little bit about last night. Tell me, exactly what were you doing?"
"I told you. I was just sitting there watching the show."
"What were you watching at the time? Do you remember?" Dina thought for a moment.
"Oh, it was something about Christmas. They were singing, 'They wanted a little Christmas early,' and there was a tree. That's all I remember."
Dr. Diggers was busy writing. "Let me ask you this. Does anything about Christmas or a Christmas tree trigger anything for you?" Dina looked at her blankly.